You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our studio guest today on Bookmark is Miranda Doyle. She'll be talking about her memoir, A Book of Untruths. We'll also hear from Rob Shorland Ball talking about his book on Cambridge Station, and also from the Bolsham Map Project, how you map a village history through maps. But first of all, welcome to the show, Miranda. Nice to have you here.
Lovely to be here. Thank you.
And we're talking really about a lot about place today in the other two interviews. So just a quick, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but a quick chat with you about place. You weren't born in Cambridge, were you?
No, I was born in Edinburgh. My parents moved around a lot, so I haven't really had a home until I moved here.
You feel that Cambridge is your home?
Well, I did until Brexit, and then it feels as though the country doesn't, I don't feel like I can belong to what it believes in at the moment, and that feels very hard.
So, I mean, Cambridge as a city was one of the most pro-Remain,
yes,
if not in the country.
But I think when you're in Scotland, people talk about what's going on with the referendum. They want to talk about it, and they do vociferously. Whereas here, everyone's very quiet. People don't enter into those conversations. And so when I apologise to people who are European at the station who are serving me with a ticket, you can see that they're quite tearful when I apologise, because they don't realise that actually quite a lot of us are with them.
You do apologise?
Oh, I do, every time. Because I'm so ashamed.
And do you consider yourself Scottish?
My father is Irish, but I've got this appalling accent, so I sound, I don't know.
You slipped into Scottish earlier on.
I did. So I had a very wicked Scottish accent when I was a child, and my mother felt it needed to be sorted out. And so now I sound much better how my mother always wanted me to sound.
Okay, give us a blast of that Scottish accent that you did before.
It's difficult to find it often.
Not that difficult.
And so it's difficult. I really feel strongly for these Europeans who might feel ashamed of where they come from and the way they sound because they've got an accent, and because that's really where I come from. My mother felt ashamed of the way I sounded, and part of putting me through public school was to get rid of that.
We're going to be talking a lot about your mother and father, but we'll listen to your first choice of
music now,
which is David Bowie and Space Oddity. Why this one?
Well, I don't know whether all adolescents feel this, but it's sort of a sense that you're sort of stuck out and the communication with the rest of the world is sort of obscure, and that's what I loved about it.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. 3, 2, check ignition, 1. And may God's love be with you.
Lift off. Space Oddity by David Bowie, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest, Miranda Doyle. Miranda graduated with an MA in creative writing from Goldsmiths, University of London. She was mentored through the Arts Council Escalator Scheme, and her autobiographical story, Autopsy, was selected by Irvine Welsh for inclusion in the Scottish Book Trust's Days Like This anthology and broadcast on Radio Scotland. A Book of Untruths, her first book, mixes memoir with scientific and psychological research. It's a family story told through lies. Each of the episodic 72 chapters explores one particular lie, its genesis and impact. The Guardian said of it, Doyle challenges the reader to stick with her tense, candid, sage testimony to the last unsettling, rewarding word. It's a remarkable book. I really enjoyed it, but it is unsettling. Did you know it was going to be unsettling? Were you aware of its effect on the reader when you were writing it?
I didn't. I was having fun. I was supposed to be writing fiction, and I would work at night on these lies, and it was a way of trying to organise the sort of drama that was going on in my family, and trying to sort of work out what had been going on and what was going on, and it was a way of trying to enjoy the page, because I wasn't enjoying the revelations of around my father's deceit, and so. But also in terms of the reader, I wanted to include them. So I was hoping that there would be space for them to reflect on their own, because we all do it, don't we? We all lie. And yes. I wanted, and all of us have had terrible lies told to us too. And I suppose I wanted there to be space for everyone to think about those things and perhaps grieve about them, perhaps.
And it's unsettling because you are, as you say, you're letting us into your family,
yes,
in a quite a candid and honest way. You're,
yes,
revealing the flaws, warts and all.
Yes.
And some of the family members, most of them in fact, are alive.
Yes.
How did you deal with that? What's your responsibility to them?
Well, I couldn't imagine that anyone would want to publish this, so I just kept it to myself. And then a few months in, I told my brothers. I have three, and I told them, one of them I wasn't speaking to, and I told them that someone wanted to publish it, but I didn't give them the script, and this caused huge irritation. Huge. But I think it's a kind of rule amongst memoirists that you have to show those people who are in it before it's published, so that they can have a recourse. And I think those who don't show their characters the text beforehand are likely to get sued. And that happens quite a lot. And privacy in this country is very, very difficult if you haven't sought permission from characters first. So my brothers were furious.
So the first time they saw it was when it was published?
No, just before, in the final editing stage. And the brother who I thought would be most supportive was the most angry. It was very interesting. And the brother I wasn't speaking to, it's meant that we have a relationship again now. So it's had the completely opposite effect than I expected. I thought he would sue me. But actually he reached out.
And what was the anger of the other brother? What was that about?
Well, it was about privacy. He felt that this is a story other people shouldn't know about him, which I think is very fair. Very fair. And that he would like to keep these stories to himself, which I think is completely understandable.
And was your mother alive when the book was published? And she knew you were writing?
No.
I mean, there's a lot obviously about your mother, and particularly your father,
yes,
and the brutal parenting style,
yes,
abusive parenting style, and abusive relationship he had with your mother.
Yes.
How difficult was that for you to explore? There's some uncomfortable truths, actually,
yes,
emerge in this book of lies.
Well, the Autopsy, which was published by the Scottish Book Trust, my mother had been alive when I'd gone off to see his brain, and that's when she wrote a little note to me saying, I give you full permission to write anything that you want. So she'd obviously seen that I was prepared to do anything. But I think it's much safer to wait till your biggest characters are dead.
And you say you were prepared to do anything. Why was that?
I felt that we, all of us, deserve truthfulness, and we deserve that ourselves can be much weakened by the fact that our memories are taken away from us when somebody has lied, so that our memories no longer have any currency. They just kind of fantasy, in a sense.
Although it's hard for you to be truthful. You said to in the book yourself, I want to tell you my story as truthfully as I can, but I must warn you, I have lied on occasion too.
That's an underestimation. I think that's what the biggest and thing about writing this book for me was realizing that, you know, I was pointing fingers at my father, but actually I was terrible myself, and I've turned over a new leaf.
At what stage did the structure come to you? What stage do you think this is, the lies can actually work as a form of structure?
It was because I was doing it sort of piecemeal at night in this enjoyable kind of furious that you can deliver that. It's like a poem. You can kind of sketch that out in a short period of time. So it actually was just time. And also I think our lives are in pieces, that we remember in pieces. And so that fragmentation is quite a good way of thinking about a life. And so it just... I wish I could say I'd really sat down and planned it, but it was much more around literally having time.
And there were, I think it was, to say, 72 chapters,
yes.
each with a lie. That is a lot of lies in one family. I mean, I know lots of families have lots of lies, but that is, and some of these lies that you cover are massive.
Yes. What was interesting was when the book was taken on by an agent, there wasn't as many as 72, but she just said, just keep going.
Just bump it up.
We just need more. And so that much more of the science came in at that point. And I guess those don't relate to me, but are around understanding generally what humans do when they lie to one another and where that comes from.
There's a challenge, I suppose, in getting over the complexity of the situation and the relationships as well. I mean, it's dedicated to your mum and dad, and the dedication says you're always more loving and more complex than I have been able to write.
Yes, and I feel that's... I wish I could... I think that's what's so terrible about deceit is that I can't recover them. Because I don't trust my memories anymore, and that feels very sad. And that's ultimately, I think, the biggest thing I learned about this, that in lying, they've kind of destroyed memories of themselves, and that feels terrible, really sad.
And you uncovered more lies,
yes,
as you went along.
Yes.
So
yes,
your relationship with them was changing, and your,
yes,
relationship with your own childhood.
Yes, and then because they're no longer with us, it's very hard to kind of recover them in that process.
There are photos in the book which,
yes,
are fantastic. There's often a disconnect between the photographs and what you're telling us. I think particularly with your dad, because he looks very sophisticated and handsome,
he's gorgeous.
Well. And he's, you know, there are moments in the text where he's an absolute brute.
Yes, I think part of I was. Teaching on the philosophy course at Anglia Ruskin around the philosophy of self. And we remember things through photographs, or photographs stand in for our memories. And yet photographs tend to be a lie. We've all been to that Christmas where we all had a hugely horrible time, but we've all had to stand around the Christmas tree and say cheese and look loving towards one another, when actually it's been a complete debacle from start to finish. So that was why the photographs are there. They're kind of proof, but they're also problematic themselves.
They are. Well, we'll come back to now. We're taking a sidestep now, a very big sidestep really, to Cambridge Station. Rob Schorlenball grew up in Cambridge, worked for BR at Cambridge Station, and was Deputy Head and Project Development Director at the National Railway Museum in York from 1987 to 1994. So it was probably always inevitable then that he would write a book about Cambridge Station. But I asked Rob what it was about trains generally that fascinated him.
I think it's the whole mechanism of the working railway. I'm certainly interested in steam trains and in more modern trains, but a railway is a very complicated, integrated machine, and we as passengers only see one bit of it, but the goods side is another bit, and actually operating, driving the locomotives and maintaining them and looking after them, and of course the whole signalling and control system. And many people are really very unaware of all these things, and I've told some of these stories in my book.
Yes, the book. How did this come about?
It was because of an interest that I've had, and I've longed to write about it because nobody has actually written a definitive book about Cambridge Station, and I'm not insulting those who have put some information together about it, but it's a very significant station. It's an important route centre. I've called it an entrepôt in my book, not to be European, but because I'm a geographer by training. And it certainly was a centre for railways and routes going eastwards into East Anglia, northwards and westwards to the coal fields, and of course southwards to London. And we have to remember that in railway terms, you go up to London and down to the north.
Yes, I've never understood that, but that's a railway term, is it?
Those are the railway terms, because, of course, Cambridge Station has a very, very long platform. And it had trains coming from London, which were down trains if they were coming from London, and there were up trains coming to Cambridge that were on their way to London. Now, you can't get two trains on the platform if they're going in opposite directions, or you can, but it could be disastrous. So they had to work out how to overcome that problem, and they overcame it with what's called a scissors crossing right in the middle of the length of the platform. And it's still there. If you look over the edge of the platform, there it is. So the trains from London could come in and turn over the scissors crossing and go to platform four if they're going on northwards, they're down trains, and the trains that were coming from the north or from King's Lynn, for instance, could come to the scissors crossing and go to platform one, which is the London end.
And you call this a definitive book. It is very thorough. Can you give our listeners an idea of some of the things you cover?
Well, I didn't call it a definitive book. It's very nice that other people have called it a definitive book, because I'm always learning. But what I have done is to cover the history of the development of Cambridge Station, and particularly it's been important to destroy the myth that the university decided where the station was to be. That's simply not so, because the land where the station is and much other railway land in Cambridge was sold to the railway by the college, quite properly. It was a very sensible thing to do. So that's part of the story of Cambridge Station, but I have covered the operation of the station and how goods traffic worked, how the locomotives were looked after, and then I've told some personal stories because I worked on the station. I was a goods porter on the station. So, for instance, I bet you didn't know about the Royal Fish.
The Royal Fish? No, I don't know about that.
Well, as a goods porter, you sometimes did passenger portering work, and I remember Lady Halifax, who I was sent to carry a bag for, actually gave me half a crown, which was in the 1960s, was an extraordinary amount of money. She was fascinated to find somebody who was clearly a young boy and going on to university. But the Royal Fish, these were the sort of jobs that the inspectors would come, and they'd just poke their head round the porter's room if we were there having a cup of tea or whatever, and in this case, Bob, Royal Fish on the next Lynn, platform four, just have a look around it and put some more sawdust down. Well, you knew not to ask the inspectors what they were talking about. The other porters told me what to do. When the Queen was at Sandringham, near King's Lynn, and that was why it was the Lynn train, then sometimes fish was sent from London to her, and it was sent on a passenger train in the brake van, where the guard was, in this case at the front of the train. And so one of the porters said, "Look, just take a bit of sawdust up and have a look, Rob." And you probably don't remember the old very heavy wooden boxes that fish and ice used to be in. So I walked up to the head of the train got into the break, and there, sure enough, were two heavy wooden boxes labelled HM the Queen and with salmon written on them. And because there was a bit of leakage, obviously, of the moisture inside, there was a ring of sawdust around them. And so I put some more sawdust down, said, "I hope you enjoy these, Your Majesty," and got off the train. And I never heard from Sandringham, so I hope they were all right. I assume that they were.
So is Cambridge a station that has gone through a lot of changes in its lifetime?
Yes, it has. It now has an island platform again, so it's bigger in terms of platforms, but it had an island platform over 100 years ago too. Didn't work terribly well, and the only way to it was over a footbridge, which was very steep. They hadn't got lifts in those days, and the ladies particularly were not very happy about that. And the porters were not very happy, this was long before my time, because the trunks and things went down steps and then in a rather frosty little tunnel under the tracks and then back up again. So it wasn't an easy station to work in that way. So that island platform went, and they continued with the very long platform, the scissors crossing, and what are called bay platforms at either end, which I'm sure those of you who know Cambridge Station will remember.
And what's the biggest change that it's had in its history?
I think it's got smaller, not the station itself, but it was surrounded by a huge number of goods yards, and it was four railway companies were operating to Cambridge and sometimes were not always agreeing with each other about what they should do, so it was quite complex. Now, we have, of course, TOC, train operating companies now, and Greater Abellio is the principal TOC at Cambridge, but I think it's the fact that nearly all of the sidings, the goods sidings and things, have gone now because there's much less goods traffic. So the station site is smaller. And the other huge change is the signalling arrangements, which have become more and more modern. If you remember when you had a look in the book, there is a rather complicated picture showing just how many signal boxes controlled Cambridge, and the station itself had five signal boxes, let alone some of the ones that were further up towards London and further down towards the north. And that was all old mechanical signalling, generally signal men, because it was believed then that ladies or women weren't strong enough to pull the leaders. That's probably nonsense. And indeed, during the wars, there were often lady signalmen, or signal persons, perhaps we should say. But now it's all electronic. And in fact, funnily enough, it's now controlled from away from Cambridge. There isn't a Cambridge signal box any longer.
And is it still fit for purpose, do you think, Rob? Because the amount of traffic, rail traffic, has increased massively over the last few years.
It has indeed, and I think it is becoming more fit for purpose. The additional island platform has made quite a difference in providing additional platforms. And, of course, the whole development of CB1, the front of the station, has been helpful. And I was amused, you as a Cambridge person will not be surprised, to learn that the hotel, one of the hotels being developed just outside the station, included a cycle park. For how many cycles? 3,000 cycles. But at least they're safely put away there rather than littering the forecourt, aren't they, which they used to do. So, yes, I think it is fit for purpose and it's being very well run.
And what's your favourite bit of the station? If you work there, you must know it like the back of your hand. Do you have a favourite part?
I think it's a favourite part with memories because a lot of the bits that I remember have gone. But down by platforms 5 and 6, the bay platform, which were the down bay platforms, there was the down end porter's room where we could make cups of tea and sit round and listen to what the other porters were saying. There was the inspector's room, and they were the boss people. They were very powerful people. They told us what to do. And the station announcer was in the down end inspector's room as well. So those were not necessarily places, all of which I went to, but that I was certainly aware of and enjoyed, and they're still there, although they're being used for different purposes now.
And how long did this book take you to write?
I think it took about 3 years altogether to write, because, of course, once the writing is done, then the editing process is quite a lengthy one. But my publishers, P&S in Barnsley, P&S Transport in Barnsley, very good, very helpful, very supportive. And I'm very pleased with the result, and I hope other people are.
And Cambridge Station by Rob Shorland-Ball is, as he said, published by Pen and Sword Transport. Our studio guest on Bookmark today is Miranda Dawe, talking about A Book of Untruths, her memoir, which is published by Faber and Faber. That's very nice, Miranda.
Yes,
how did
amazing.
That publishing deal come about?
I had an offer from one other publisher, and I wanted to go with the other publisher, and my agent said, why? And I said, well, I'm not good enough for Faber. This is ridiculous. And she said, you're making the wrong decision, and I'm going to ring you back in 5 minutes and you're going to make the right one.
All right, that's and you're told.
They were both offering the same money, which wasn't very much, not enough to pay off my student loan. So that's, if you want to become a writer out there, you need another job.
You need another job. And how did it feel once it was published and the words were out there and these very personal things out in the public domain? How did it feel?
I'm not aware of that. I think those people who've read it can see that I'm buck naked and screaming, but I'm not really aware how much I've exposed myself. I suppose because I know all of this, so it doesn't feel as undressed as I probably am.
Well, you're not that undressed. You're not that undressed. It's all safe. We'll hear your second choice of music now, which is PJ Harvey to bring you My Love. Why did you choose this one?
When I eventually escaped that Borstal in northern Scotland, the public school I was at, I spent a lot of time in London sort of stomping around in this sort of angry PJ Harvey way, just shagging everyone that moved.
And this song reminds you of that time.
It does.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Yes, welcome back to Bookmark with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest, Miranda Doyle, talking about her memoir, A Book of Untruths. And you're going to read an extract for us now, Miranda.
Yes. I have three brothers, and if you can imagine, the tallest one is Adrian, the eldest. He's blonde. Then the middle one is Sean. He's dark and dark-haired. And then there's little Scotty Ed, who is redheaded, so they've all got different colour hair. And Ed's like me, I've red hair too. And this is the shortest lie, because I really worry about boring people. So lie 12, we don't have favourites. It is the summer of 1974, and we are camping in Brittany. The caravan has been dragged all the way from Edinburgh and plonked behind the grassy dunes. Every night we play cards, bouchon, with a painter and his wife. The game requires quantities of bottles of wine to be drunk fast, so as to provide corks. It must be evening, the adults already a bottle or two in, because the sun is low in the west, the wind blowing horizontal the way it does in Brittany. The beach, which is never very full, is now deserted, and we are digging a hole. Ed ignored all day, has in his desperation to be out of Coventry, agreed to Sean's suggestion that he be buried up to his neck. The tide creeps towards us as we dig. Adrian decides that we'll just do him standing up. Ed is small enough to make it only a little more work, and he and Sean agree it will make it much harder to escape. Ed climbs in, his grave nice and deep. Sean, pleased by Adrian's attention, compacts the sand hard. Ed flinches beneath his hands, the sand splitting the way it does when a body moves beneath it, great cracks opening up. Sean and Adrian bait him to keep still. Soon he is crying, and I am running over the dune my bare feet sliding through the sand. Sean and Adrian are with me. I run because I don't want to be there when Ed is found, the sea circling his neck. Sean and Adrian are running because it is funny. They laugh and shout at our little brother from the safety of the dunes, the tide flooding in. They tell him we are leaving him. He will drown. I look back from deep within the mahia grass and I see Ed's wee head, camouflaged, his red hair melding with the sand, and I hear the terrible sound of his terror.
He does survive, we should say.
Yes, he does survive. He does.
As you say, you've got three brothers. You say in the book, this is not the tale my brothers would tell of themselves. What tale would they tell then? Very different to yours?
Well, Sean, who I worry about the most, he's adopted. And can feel very angry.
Your parents adopted him.
Yes, my parents adopted him. And I worried about what his reaction would be. But he contacted the publisher looking for a ghostwriter to write his own version. He's bought tons of these books and is giving them out to everyone because he feels like the hero. I wonder how other people see him. Perhaps I think a lot of readers think he's fantastic.
So he is writing his own version.
Well, I don't know. He obviously doesn't feel he can trust me to write it for him.
What would they say about you? Because your book is a lot about them. What do you think they would say about you?
Sean thinks I'm very angry. And I should try and put my anger away. I think that's projection. I think he's the one who's probably very angry too. My youngest brother Ed has emigrated to get away from this.
Seriously?
I think it did make him feel much more frail and fragile. About, but also the referendum has accentuated that. But I think he wanted to get away from this story, yes. And my eldest brother Adrian took me to an event in Scotland and took the stage with me, which was so sweet of him because I was so scared about being there myself. And he told everyone that actually I was wrong about who burnt the lino.
He had
burnt it himself.
Have you any regrets then about writing this book?
No, none.
Because it's obviously sent ripples, if not shockwaves.
Yes. I turned up for another event in Edinburgh and my aunt came and heckled from the back. And So there have been quite strong reactions. But I think being truthful, one shouldn't be punished for it, I think.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? I don't quite know what to say to that. I mean, that's being heckled by your own aunt. Was she your brother's sister or your mother's sister?
My mother's. And I laugh about it because I've been told that actually what some people hate most is not being in the book at all, which she isn't.
and you said, I mean, your mum, you assign... Well, your words in the book, if we were to assign character roles, there's no question that Mum is our victim.
Yes, yes.
At what stage did you realise the true nature of your parents' relationship?
Not until after my father had died. And I suppose I found it very challenging that she would come clean then, when she felt safe to tell it. But there was no recourse for any of us. But she was obviously itching to tell us all really how it had been.
He had, just to make it clear, he had affairs and she contracted sexually transmitted diseases.
Yes,
Because of those affairs. And he moved abroad at one stage to go for a job. And the understanding was she and you, the children, would follow him. But he clearly didn't want he hadn't got visas or renewed passports.
No,
or,
nothing.
And she only found that out
after he'd gone. Yes, yes.
Right, well, we'll absorb that. As we absorb that, we can listen to the Bolsham Map Project. In 2013, Bolsham resident Margaret Creek discovered the existence of the oldest known map of the village. That triggered 4 years of research to compile a history of Bolsham based on maps alongside first-person recollections and family photographs. When I went along to the launch of the book in the Black Bull pub in Bolsham, of course, I asked her to tell me more about how she decided what to include in it.
It covers basically the first map of 1617, and then we weren't too sure what to put in it. I'd got a rough outline of how it might look, and then we got people on board who've helped with the maps, obviously, and we've sort of put flesh on the bones with the people's stories, as well as the maps interspersed. We've got maps interspersed. The gem in the book, I think, is the 1874 map, which was hand-drawn by we don't know whom, and it lists all the names of the people that lived in the village at the time, and that is absolutely beautiful.
And are some of those families still here?
Oh yes, oh very much so, yes, yes, yes.
Has it changed much over the years, Bolsham, then? You're in a prime position to know, because you've got maps here dating from 400 years ago.
The basic outline hasn't changed of the village, no, the shape has remained the same if you look at the early maps and the modern maps. It's just expanded, really, the population. But unfortunately, the facilities decreased. It's sort of not quite just a commuter place, but, yeah, we've lost the butcher shop, which is now a very nice coffee shop. We've got our post office still, and we have another pub up the village, the Bell, which is sort of hanging in there. So, yeah, it's a lot of people, but not so much facilities now, which I think is a lot of people in the same place.
So if people buy this book, they'll find out what Bolsham looked like through the years, really, through the last four centuries.
Yeah, and there's a lot more out there waiting to be discovered, or we've discovered it, but haven't had time to print it. So we're hoping somebody else will carry on where we've left off. I'm quite happy to advise them, but I'd never do it again. It's been absolutely fascinating. I've enjoyed it. But it is quite hectic if you've got no idea what you're doing. You just rely on the expertise, which I'm so grateful for, that have supported me through the project.
And what was the inspiration for this book?
I don't know, really. It's just some of these light bulb moments. You think, that's a good idea. And I said I'd give it up if it kept me awake at night. And I'd have given it up ages ago, and probably last week as well. It does concern you.
You saw a map, didn't you?
Yes,
you saw the original map. Was that what set you off on the journey?
Yeah, we saw the copy of the map. Then we went up to the London Metropolitan Archives, and the real one was up there, the original 1617. And they brought it out, and they sort of, it wasn't a white gloves job. They pulled it out, and we saw it. It's all beautifully handwritten by Thomas Lagden, which caused more interest because they discovered all about him. And his history as well, and his story about Charterhouse. I've been to Charterhouse, lunched with the brothers there, because there's still a connection with Charterhouse and Bolsham. It's not just a bridge over the A11, the Charterhouse. You'll find out if you read the book.
Okay. What was the most surprising thing that you found out about Bolsham?
How much history has been written about it, and how important it was at the beginning of where the map was written. Yeah, the connections and the power that people had in this tiny little place, really.
It's quite a detailed map of the village now. Who did you get to do that?
The maps, so we had them from the local archives and the national archives, census records, newspapers, you name it, and we put it all together.
And you're giving a free copy of this book to every house in Bolsham?
To every house in Bolsham. This has been in another village, not so very far away, but we haven't been so lucky with funding, sort of local and national funding. Books are not seen as a worthy cause, but I think people will be delighted with it, and I hope we've proved them wrong.
And has it made you feel differently about the village?
Yeah, I was a bit concerned about having this big launch day, I'll be honest. I'd rather have just gone around and just put books in letterboxes. But no, you've got to have a big display all this and celebrate it.
But the book, in a way, has brought the village together, which is...
I hope it has. And somebody will no doubt would say, oh, no, you've got that wrong, this wrong and that wrong. Well, now's your chance to put it right for the next edition if somebody wants to carry on.
And you've got personal recollections in here as well.
Oh, yes, personal recollections.
How did you choose who to interview?
I used to ask for people to say, would they like to share their memories? Photographs are of local interest. Jan Ellam, she's from the families in the village from way back, and she's got a big collection that her mother gathered years and years ago, her mum Pam. And she's carried that on, you see. That's a treasure trove of people. And you look at the people there and you see people today and you can see they're all related.
And talk me briefly through the book. So when you open, yeah, it is a lovely book. I mean, it's quite a large book, isn't it? And there's the original map.
176 pages.
176 big pages as well. And there's the original map on the front cover. And so you're looking through the 1617 map.
1617 map.
There it is. And then what happens then?
Then we have the copy done in 1791.
And you can see all the fields. Of...
Yeah, and all the fields, all the strip farming, which is another interesting thing that drew from this, all the strip farming, we copied all these out, all the group, all the strip farming.
The strip farming, by that you mean that each field has been divided into strips with a name on it.
Before
is this
enclosure,
enclosures, yeah.
Yeah, before enclosure. We've copied all these out and they're all on a database, a spreadsheet, and you can look at them, I think, with these modern technologies, completely above my head. But these are all recorded and they are basically in the back of the book here.
Oh, yes.
That's the modern map.
Yeah, that's the modern map. So that's...
It's difficult on radio to explain.
It is. It's the old map that was black and white, but you've done it in colours.
Yeah, it's in colour. The strip farming is in colours. And one of the strip farming here, one of the gentlemen. And this is just one family, the Rural family. And these are the strips that they...
Owned in the different fields.
In different fields.
Gosh, they had quite a walk, didn't they, between the land they owned?
They did indeed.
So they owned in total sort of about 20 strips, but spread over very many acres.
Yeah. So this is the terrain map, how high and how low we are in the village. This is all by Seppi Casateri, our wonderful map-making man.
You've got some aerial photos.
Aerial pictures that Seppi's taken as well.
And so, what's the text about? What do you cover actually in the text?
Oh, let's have a look.
Each building, the buildings.
Well, it's the people that. Some of the buildings have been covered before, but.
The farms.
It's just the farms. The farms of Bolsham, work and play. The 1806 map, which is after enclosure. People from the past, these various families. I've done the Prince family, who are quite prominent in the village. They are fascinating. There's still more stuff to do about them. They're very, very interesting. And the same with there's a May family as well in the village. And then you've got the services, buses, carriers, electricity, water, fire. And Bolsham doing conflict, yeah.
So this is during the First World War and
the First World War and the Second World War. Streets and houses. Then these are the new estates. Education. Yeah. It's all in here. A little bit of everything, I hope.
You've set something up for somebody, as you say, to continue, should they wish to.
I hope so. And so if we've got it wrong, just we apologise in advance. But now's your chance to put us right and perhaps carry on where we left off.
What do you want, if there was one thing that you wanted somebody to take away from this book, what would it be?
Walking in the footsteps of these people from years ago. When you walk down, say, Woodhall Lane and you look at the allotments and things and you know from what the research we've done who was actually doing their farming on that piece of land all those years ago and wonder what they would have made of all this now. And I hope that Thomas, who did the original map, would be pleased. And he wasn't far out with his measurements, even though they used all these primitive equipment. With the modern map, you put it over the old map, and the borders and the boundaries are much the same.
That's Margaret Creek there talking about the Bolsham Map Project. And you can find out more about that at the website bolshammap.net. We're coming to the end of our time with you on Bookmark, Miranda Doyle, I'm afraid to say. But Margaret there talking about pulling this book together. It was obviously a labour of love for her.
Yes.
I wonder if your relationship with your family changed as you wrote your book.
Yes, I think actually what's been most profound is my relationship with friends, who I'd kept since I was a child, they're over. And they were characters in the book, and I thought I had been very kind about them. But I think in a sense, perhaps people feel used. And so it had a profound effect on many, many relationships, actually. Yes.
This book has changed your life, really, hasn't it? I mean, it really has changed your relationships with people.
Yes, yes. And my husband is in it as a character as well. He's been very, very kind. And the piece of music at the end is really about meeting him. And of course, I managed to snare him through lies. No one else would have me.
They come in handy now and again.
So some people have been much more generous, but I think a lot of people understandably just feel that I've taken their lives and used them for myself, maybe.
And do you think you have?
That wasn't my intention. That wasn't my intention. But I guess it's like listening to yourself on an answering machine message, that you sound very dislocated from what you think you sound like. And maybe people have read this and thought, really? That's not me. She's misrepresented who I thought I was.
If you could go back and do it again, would you do it any differently?
I think I wouldn't do it because I don't think I could have done it any differently, I feel. Yeah. I mean, what's been most amazing is how kind people who don't know me have been about the book. That they felt it was very readable, and that's been the most amazing thing to me.
It is incredibly readable. I would recommend it to anyone. It's A Book of Untruths by Miranda Doyle, and it's published by Faber and Faber. And one final question to you, Miranda. We ask all our guests this. Just what are you reading at the moment?
I am the personal assistant to the Herschel Smith Professor of Molecular Genetics, and so therefore I'm reading Narcissism in the Life Sciences.
Narcissism in the Life Sciences. Page Turner.
It really isn't.
Well, a heads up on our next show, our studio guest will be, well, there's kind of YA and children's writers theme to the next show. Our studio guest will be in Bali at Surly. She'll be talking about her Foxcraft series. We'll also hear from Julian Sedgwick on completing his Ghosts of Shanghai trilogy, and Rosemary Hayes has written 40 books over 30 years for children. We'll be talking to her too. But we will sign out now with your last choice of music, Miranda. You kind of referenced it earlier. It's the Stabat Mater. Why have you chosen this one?
I came along Trinity Street, and Heifer's Music used to be in that piece of shops, and coming out of the door was this amazing music, and that's it. Reminds me of Cambridge.